Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, that 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, feds infiltrated our movement for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin sale pro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit's gonna be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise. Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, that 13th Amendment. Tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit that don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prisons. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
PEN America stands at the intersection of free expression and literature. And what that means is that PEN does not believe that literary culture can thrive unless writers and readers can write freely, think freely, and share ideas freely. We are a membership organization, so our membership helps us do the work that we do. If you want to hear more about what PEN does or read more about what PEN does, please visit us at PEN.org. Now, you're in for a dynamic conversation tonight, and I just want to tell you a little bit about our speakers. Dr. Tiffany Crutcher is a native of Tulsa, Oklahoma, who was thrust... into the national spotlight following the death of her twin brother, Terrence, who was shot by a police officer in Tulsa, Oklahoma, while holding his hands in the air. The murder of her brother compelled Tiffany to speak out against police brutality, particularly the killing of unarmed black men. She has chosen to turn her personal tragedy into an opportunity to bridge fear and mistrust and help transform a justice system that has continually perpetrated injustice dating back to 1921, the Tulsa Race Massacre, where mobs of white rioters burned down her great-grandmother's community known as Black Wall Street. Dr. Crutcher has remained committed to organizing coalitions throughout the country that promote the interests of minority communities. She is the founder of the Terrence Crutcher Foundation and the Demanding a Justice Tulsa Coalition. The foundation's primary focus is criminal justice and policing reform, providing scholarships to African-American students, communities, youth development, and policy advocacy. Our other featured speaker today is Onika Asoma Caesar. Now, Jeff mentioned her earlier. She is the founder and owner of the Fulton Street Bookstore. She is a mother, a daughter of the Middle Passage, and a true Enneagram 8. She is the owner, as I mentioned before, of Fulton Street Books and Coffee here in Tulsa. I went today. It is fantastic. It's wonderful, curated. It's a beautiful communal space. And it's a space that centers the stories and narratives and lived experiences of black, indigenous people of color. She believes in literacy has liberation and is proud to be your local book dealer. Nicole Hannah-Jones. Nicole is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter covering racial injustice for the New York Times Magazine and the creator of the landmark 1619 Project. Prior to joining the New York Times, Nicole worked as an investigative reporter at ProPublica in New York City, where she spent 3 years chronicling the ways official policy created and maintained segregation in housing and schools. Nicole started her journalism career covering the majority black Durham public schools for the News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina. During her 3 years there, she wrote extensively on issues of race, class, schooling, and equity. Now, before we begin, and I invite the speakers to the stage, I want us to take a moment of reflection. On this day, 101 years ago, at the historic Booker T. Washington High School in the Greenwood District of Tulsa, students and teachers were preparing for the school's prom. Now, that prom never happened, because on that night, the Greenwood community was destroyed by the worst demonstration of racial violence in this country's history. I ask that you please join me for a moment of silence for all the lives lost and communal connections destroyed during this devastating act of anti-blackness. All right. Thank you. Now let's bring the speakers to the stage.
Good evening, Tulsa. Greenwood by Jasmine Mann. The whistle of an unnatural wind gave word there would be a lynching of a Negro boy who shined shoes. Not a rapist, just a boy, a child boy, a teenage boy, 19-year-old boy still fresh in his days, and a wind that would not know the enormity of its crime until morning filled air with turpentine, an invasion led by Klansmen, a hate that would outdo itself to a menacing ritual of fire, wood, and blood. The bombs turned clouds into shadows of themselves. Single-engine aircraft hovered so low, the bodies under them thought the world was ending. How could it not be? Run, Negro. 35-ish blocks in a flame that spent days burning itself tired. 300 black folks murdered into anonymity. Greenwood has a soggy muck clay, a damp inconsistency of earth, constitution, and bone. Some buried homeless in Oaklawn, some trampled beneath the dirt. A history tucked away in attic floorboards, long enough to forget all it once was. America has a way of dancing with its own delusion, unable to keep count of its murders, because then it would have to keep count of its murders. Its good neighbors. All insurance claims denied to residents of Greenwood and black business owners of Black Wall Street, and left the people holding their memory through tongue, folklore, blood, postcard, and church tale. A people chasing a memory that wasn't supposed to become a memory at all. I just want to jump right into it. I don't even want to waste any time. Can we just keep it real and speak truth tonight? So if you're ready, I need you to scream that I'm ready. Nicole, we are so glad that you're here. Why was it important to add this poem about Greenwood in the 1619 Project? And what have you learned about the community, this community, through this project?
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming out today. Very honored to be here on this particular day and to be in conversation with you both. I'm going to answer your question, but if you've watched any of my interviews, you know I just go rogue. So I'm going to go a little rogue, but I'm going to answer your question for sure. So I am in Oklahoma on this day on purpose. As states all across the country started trying to legislate against the 1619 Project and ban the 1619 Project, I decided that I wanted to go into all the places that were trying to ban us. So, thank you. Oh, y'all gonna be easy. Okay. Thank you. Oh, okay. Thank you. And it was important to start this here for a few reasons. So one, let me just state very clearly. Healthy societies don't ban books. Healthy societies don't ban ideas. And so it is necessary to go into the very places that are trying to suppress our history and force a confrontation with that history. And if any place understands that, it's Tulsa. Because the reason I wanted to come here is many people, as you know, found out about Tulsa by watching Watchmen.
That's true.
And thought that they were watching something fictional. And we know that in this state, school children weren't even being taught about the history of what happened in their own state. This is why the 1619 Project had to exist in the first place, right? Because we know that there's history, which is what happened on what day and who did it, and then there's history, which is what we're taught about what happened on what day and who did it. And most of us learn the history that's been manipulated, that's been managed by people in power to justify their power. And so they erase all of the things about our history that call into question the legitimacy of that power. And you can't understand Tulsa and not understand Black America, and you can't understand Tulsa and not understand America. So that's why it was important to have the story of Greenwood in the 1619 Project. Because when I think of a seminal event that explains so much, particularly when we look at why do Black Americans struggle, right? Why do we have such an economic disadvantage? And what we're told, if you just watch, you know, popular culture, if you read the news, if you get a kind of common history, the manipulated history that we all get, is that somehow Black people are the only people in the history of the world who don't like nice neighborhoods, who don't want quality schools, who like crime, who won't work for what they want. Or you study history and it all becomes very clear that the circumstances we live in are the most predictable circumstances based on the history that Black people have experienced in this country. So if you want to know why don't Black people have wealth, it's not because we didn't work for it. It's not because we didn't work harder than anyone else to get it. It's because it was systematically destroyed, right?
Yeah.
If you want to understand, it was violently destroyed. Like, in the 1619 Project, we try to avoid euphemism in all ways. So we don't call this period Jim Crow. We call it the violently enforced, terroristically enforced period of racial apartheid, because that's what it was.
Yeah.
And yeah, Tulsa is reflective of what we saw all over the country. If you want to see the most intense violence, it was always in response to Black prosperity.
Yes.
Because Black people were not supposed to ever prosper, because prosperous meant you had independence. If you were a prosperous Black community, you stood in the face of everything that they wanted to tell us about what Black people were. And it was an affront to white people, no matter their status, because Black people weren't supposed to have success.
Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't tell the story of 1619 and the legacy of 1619 without telling the story of what happened here in Tulsa. And I think if you understand Tulsa, if you understand that you had a thriving Black community, and that once that wealth is destroyed, I'm going to wrap this up, or you're only going to get to ask me two questions. But I thought a lot about, so of course we all know, there were hundreds of Tulsas, right, where Black communities, particularly prosperous Black communities, were destroyed violently. And we think about when an entire community or area gets destroyed by a hurricane or some other natural disaster, we understand that that community cannot rebuild on its own. So the federal government has to come in and give a lot of funding, because when every institution is destroyed, it is impossible to bootstrap your way out of that. But when Black communities were destroyed, there was no help coming. Matter of fact, the federal government was working in concert with the local and state officials to ensure that what was lost was not only not replaced, but was stolen. So we can understand then how, when you destroy an entire district and offer no assistance, you can't dig your way out of that, no matter how hard you work, no matter how industrious you are. And that is the story of Black people all across this country. It's not a people who didn't work hard, didn't acquire wealth, didn't get land, didn't build things, even though they had nothing, but that every time they did, it was systematically destroyed and there was no help to get it back. So if we want to know, I think we're going to get to reparations, so I won't step on that.
Next question.
But this is why I had to come here. I had to come here, one, because they don't want you to learn your local history. They don't want you to learn your national history, because once you understand that history, it's like taking the red pill in the Matrix, right? You see how the system was built, and then you know the code to destroy it.
Well, I think she answered all of our questions. But before, you know, I just move on, I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge my father, Reverend Joey Crutcher. And you talked about, you know, this notion of having to just climb our way out of a hill. But we got some freedom fighters in the room. I want to acknowledge our District 1 City Council, Vanessa Hall Harper. Our chairwoman of the African American Affairs Commission, Ms. Christy Williams. Our national reparations expert, Dreesen Heath, with the Human Rights Watch. Our state representative, Regina Goodwin, is in the house. Our District 1 school board member, Reverend Janetti Marshall, is in the house. Former state senator and BTW alumni, Jabbar Shoemate, is in the house. Nehemiah Frank with the Black Wall Street Times is in the house. Chief Amasan, BTW alumni, is walking around somewhere, local historian descendant. And our elders, Dale Bright, Joyce Williams, Margaret Love. And I have to give a shout out to my former teacher here, Ava Fisher, and my basketball coach, Butch Fisher. We love you. Okay, back to the regular scheduled program. So Nicole, in your New York Times article, What is Owed, you respond to every excuse made against reparations, excuses that my people didn't own slaves, and it's unfair to make people who aren't black pay for reparations. In Tulsa, we have our own reparations fight. Right now, those same excuses are being communicated by our mayor, the mayor of Tulsa, and for the native freedmen. What parallels do you see between our issues and the larger movement for reparations for the legacy of slavery?
So, one, let me just shout out all the advocates who have been working on reparations locally and nationally. The interesting thing about reparations is that is where even your most white progressive support falls off, right? So the same people who have a Black Lives Matter sign in their yard are opposed to reparations. And the polling is very clear. The majority of white Democrats, our so-called allies, are also opposed to reparations. So if you want to know what is the connection, it's anti-blackness. That is the connection. So when I wrote What is Owed, it was right after George Floyd, and I was, you know, we were allegedly in this reckoning, which of course was very fleeting because racial reckoning in America is always very fleeting. Folks get real tired real fast, that you can't turn a 400-year system in 2 weeks of protesting, and also that you might have to actually give up some shit if you, you know, want equality. So, sorry if there's some children in here, but you probably heard worse.
They did on Saturday.
Oh, I heard. I'm not going to do all that. Y'all are safe. You're safe. But what was important, so I'm watching, you know, all of this really superficial racial reckoning, like NASCAR realizing maybe you shouldn't let people fly the Confederate flag there, or Sephora saying, oh, we're going to try to have 10% of our products sold by black companies. That's all well and good, but that's superficial. Everything's superficial, right? Painting Black Lives Matter on the boulevard. And I was like, if this is really going to be the moment of racial reckoning, we have to get to the root of it, which is slavery was not a racist system. It was an economic system. Slavery, you don't transport 13 million human beings across the Atlantic just because you don't like them. You do that because you want to economically exploit these human beings for profit, and you justify that exploitation by creating racism. So as long as we can just think of slavery as racist, then we can say, well, we abolished discrimination in the law. We now have a legally equal society, so we have nothing left to do. But if you understand that slavery was a system of extracting profit, wealth from black bodies and giving that profit and wealth to white institutions and white people, and then if you understand that the 100 years that followed slavery, 100 years of violently enforced racial apartheid, was also about trying to maintain that exploitable class of labor for as long as possible, right? Jim Crow was not about racism. It was about keeping a racial hierarchy that kept black people as an exploitable class of labor, which is why black people weren't allowed to move into neighborhoods, why they weren't allowed to attend the same schools as white children, why they weren't allowed to work certain jobs. Then you understand that making equality in the law was just the beginning, that you have to do something about that 250-year economic head start and advantage that white Americans got that has left an entire race of people with almost zero wealth. So to me, to focus on policing, which matters, it obviously matters, right? Police are the enforcement arm of white supremacy, so we know that policing matters. But most of us, thank God, will not be killed by the police, but all of us will suffer from the artificial wealth poverty that we have all been forced into, nearly all of us. So anyway, I was like, in this moment of reckoning, if we're not talking about reparations, we're not actually talking about reckoning. We are losing the power of the moment. And the benefit of having studied something for 30 years almost, maybe not 30, 20, I'm not that old, is I've seen every excuse, I've seen every argument. And so when I wrote that essay, as you pointed out, I was like, I'm going to take every single argument I've heard against reparations and then using my investigative reporting lens, systematically knock it down with data and facts.
Yes, 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 yes.
So what do we know about culture? The most successful strategy against reparations has been delay until death.
That's right, that's right.
So when people say, you don't deserve reparations because it's nobody alive today who was in slavery. Well, people who were in slavery tried to get reparations. You waited till they all died, and then you said there's nobody alive. So this is what they've done, of course, with the victims of Tulsa, right? They've waited until almost everyone is gone, and then when the last three survivors are gone, they'll say, well, we don't have to pay now because there's no victims who actually experienced that. But the debt does not go away, and we all know this from the IRS, right? The debt doesn't go away with your death. And so we know that what we're seeing in Tulsa has been the template for denying black people reparations all across the country. There are living victims, of course, of racial apartheid right now, right? Our parents, many people in this room who had to live through racial apartheid. And so we're trying to wait them out as well so that we never have to pay the debt. So I think that what is critical is seeing all of the tactics for denying reparations. And this is why I ask the white folks in this room to do some soul searching about where is the opposition coming from? We know that black Americans were not given a fair chance to acquire wealth, that we were locked out of every type of program or policy, including home ownership, right? College educations that will allow you to get wealth. And we have to stop believing in this country that it's a zero-sum game, right? We can support reparations to atone for slavery, to make up for the forced wealth poverty of black Americans, but we can also have things like universal health care and student loan debt forgiveness and a living wage. Like, we're a rich country. We brag about it all the time. And one thing that I'm going rogue again. I'm about to wrap it up.
Go ahead.
One thing that we learned with the pandemic is that we can print money overnight if we want to. Right? So every excuse about, yes, reparations might be the right thing to do, but we just can't afford it. We came up with $3 trillion overnight. Right? We bailed out businesses. We bailed out folks who already had money. But when it comes to people who, as a people, black Americans are the only people in the history of the United States who had, as a people, zero wealth because of slavery. In 1865, when we finally get our liberation, we enter liberation with zero wealth, and then every time we started getting a little bit of something, that got taken away too. So why would we want to be a stingy nation that doesn't want to acknowledge, atone, and then repair? That is necessary. We can't be moral people and then just say, well, everything is equal now, so why should we have to do anything? And this is where I show all the arguments, right? There's nothing that black Americans can do on our own to eliminate 350 years of legalized racial plundering. So we go to college, we still have less wealth than white people who don't go to college. If we get married, we still have less wealth than white single moms. Right? We save a higher percentage of our income than every other race. We just have less income to save. We invest more in our children's education. We just have less money to invest in their education, so they still have to take out loans, right? If we don't have children, if we do have children, if we get married, if we buy homes, none of that eliminates the racial wealth gap in a country set up on a system of racial caste. So we have to decide, are we going to be the country that we think we are? And if that's the case, we can't deny this past. And I do think that so much of the opposition to the 1619 Project, another text, is once you know the history, you can't deny the truth anymore, then you know something is owed. So instead we say, let's not learn the history because we don't want to pay that check.
So I want to go back to the theme of anti-blackness, because one of the things you assert in the 1619 Project is that anti-blackness essentially served to preserve slavery.
Yes.
But here we are in 2022, and anti-blackness is still going strong. We exist in a world where we have laws and policies that are race silent, but the impact of those laws and policies are not race neutral. So what does anti-blackness exist to preserve today, or what do folks believe it exists?
That's a great question, and this is why they also don't want our children to learn critical race theory, like the real critical race theory, not the fake propaganda campaign that places like Oklahoma have succumbed to. But what critical race theory teaches you, if you have placed a racial hierarchy into the structures of your country, in its legal system, political system, economic systems, educational system, healthcare system, for 350 years, that system still stands once you've eliminated the law. Matter of fact, you don't have to do anything. It's self-replicating. I'm going to give you a very clear example for everyone who seems so perplexed by this. It is not about individual racism, though. There's plenty of that, too. But we can just look at housing, right? The federal government creates redlining. We all heard of redlining. We think the banks did it, but the federal government created redlining. After the Great Depression, the federal government decides it wants to try to build a middle class, but of course back then the white was always silent, so they wanted to build a white middle class, and so they decided to start insuring home loans. Prior to that, if you wanted to buy a home, you had to put down between 50 to 70%, which meant most people could never buy a home. So the government decides, federal government decides, we're going to build a middle class by insuring home loans, and if we back these loans with the federal government, you only have to put down 20% on your house, and most Americans, or many Americans, could come up, white Americans could come up with that 20%. So the government decides we need to figure out which neighborhoods should we loan in, which neighborhoods would be too risky, and which ones should we loan in, and so literally, insurers who worked for the government sat down, got maps of the city and markers, and marked in red all black neighborhoods and any neighborhood that was integrated as well as being unlendable. This is how redlining comes to be. And so, of course, all the banks follow the redlining, as do real estate agents, because it's coming from the federal government. So between the 1930s and 1968, 98% of those home loans go to white Americans. It is the largest program that built the biggest middle class in the history of the United States was when the federal government began backing home loans, and black Americans were systematically excluded from that program. So, in 1968, what happened? Anyone? 1968, we get the Fair Housing Act. How do we get the Fair Housing Act? What had to happen for us to get the Fair Housing Act? Anyone? Dr. King had to get assassinated for us to get the Fair Housing Act, because the Fair Housing Act was considered the first civil rights act for the North. So all the white congressmen who supported the 64 law, well, I guess Oklahoma was basically Jim Crow too, but Oklahoma's the South to me. But then I'm like Malcolm X, everything south of the Canadian border is the South. Anyway, so the 64 Civil Rights Act, which was about public accommodations, and the Voting Rights Act of 65 were all considered to be about the South, but the Fair Housing Act was considered to be about the North, because how we accomplished segregation in the North was through housing. If you pen black people into a restricted geographic area, you don't have to segregate schools, parks, restaurants, because you go into the segregated school in your segregated neighborhood, and you go into the parks in your neighborhood, and you go into the shops in your neighborhood. So there was great northern white opposition to the Fair Housing Act, because if housing got integrated, everything got integrated, including schools. But then Dr. King gets assassinated. There's riots, or as we would call them, rebellions all across the country, and that's how they get the Fair Housing Act. So in 1968, we can no longer redline. It is now illegal. But we didn't go back and force all those people to integrate that were forced to segregate, right? We didn't go back and change home values, because what redlining did was meant the identical house in a black neighborhood was automatically worth less than the identical house in a white neighborhood. So when black people bought homes, their homes didn't appreciate. When white people bought homes, because these were white neighborhoods and we had a racialized housing system, their home prices appreciated. More wealth, more wealth, more wealth. But we don't reset housing values and say now every house that's the same is going to have the same value. So all of that just keeps accumulating, right? Those structures keep working. So now you can be a non-racist white person, but when you move into a white neighborhood, your house is going to be worth more. And if you move into a black neighborhood, all of a sudden houses start becoming worth more. This is what critical race theory tries to help us understand, right, is that all these structures can be put in place, and it's no longer about the individual, it's about systems that were set up over decades. Unless you do something drastic to dismantle those systems, the injustice is self-replicating in and of itself. And then on top of that, we still have racism. We still have banks that discriminate against black home buyers. We still have real estate agents that discriminate against black home buyers. So we have the structure and the individual acts. And I think that is what we all have to understand, is that it is about individual racism, but it's comforting to think it's just individuals. What is discomforting is all of the people who say they want equality, are you willing to give up that artificial, undeserved home value that you have? Are you? No, right? Are you willing to say, let's get these reparations to black folks, even though they still won't catch up with you, but somehow you think that's unfair? So this is where we get stuck, is the beauty of it. Oh, to get to what you really asked. I'm sorry, I did that whole lesson. This is my problem. So the beauty of what happened after the Civil Rights Movement is up until 1968, we had explicit racism in the law. And then after 1968 and 64, 65, 68, you no longer constitutionally can be explicitly racist, right? So then we see this embrace of colorblindness. But colorblindness in opposition to taking race into account to remedy a 350-year racist system. So now if I say, well, we need programs to target black Americans because they haven't been able to be in integrated neighborhoods. They haven't been able to get home loans. They were kept out of getting jobs. Then you say that's reverse racism, right? So now we can pretend, yes, you can be colorblind now because you have a 350-year racialized system that will continue to produce racialized results, and you don't have to be explicit about it anymore. So now colorblindness is a benefit to those who want to maintain inequality. And they have adapted the language of the civil rights movement, right? This is how we all hear this one quote from Dr. King all the time, right, about content of the character, not color of the skin. But you don't want to read the rest of that speech where he talks about, you know, coming here to get our money because the government passed, a check that came back marked insufficient funds. You don't talk about that part of the speech. So colorblindness has now become dogma because it is a way to keep discrimination entrenched with a wink and a nod and say, well, we're just treating everyone equal now, though we've never had an equal society.
1,000%. True story. I am getting ready to refinance my home, and so I asked my white neighbor if I could borrow her family pictures so when they come and do the appraisal. Next question. Oklahoma's governor, Kevin Stitt, signed HB 1775, which prevents schools from teaching black history to our children in public schools. Essentially, anything that makes students with families uncomfortable, we can't teach it, and we know that means some families. The 1619 Project in this process has been used and weaponized for these fights. How do you respond to these attacks, and where do we go from here?
So one, I bet many of the black and brown folks in here wish they would have had a law like that when we had to sit through school and feel uncomfortable every day, right? I mean, having to sit up there and listen to my classmates read Tom Sawyer aloud, or being just completely erased from the curricula altogether. You know, I talk about this in the preface of the book, that when I took my first black studies course, I became so angry because I was like, you mean we had all this history that could be taught?
Yep.
And no one thought to teach it to us. So all these years when I sat in the classroom, I felt demeaned and degraded because I assumed if black people had done something important, surely somebody would have taught
something
this
more
to
than
us.
The Bushmen.
Right?
Yep.
So how I feel about it is, in some ways, it's my greatest honor that they would be so scared of a work of historical journalism that they would seek to ban it, because powerful people don't pass laws about things that are inconsequential.
Yeah.
And what we know is that they see this as a challenge to their power, because the mythology of America is what allows them to sustain the inequality that we all experience. If we believe that we are the freest, greatest country in the history of the world, capitalism is the most liberatory economic system in the face in the history of the world, and anyone who wants to achieve success in this country can, then you can blame all the inequality on individuals and our bad choices. And it doesn't challenge power. It doesn't challenge what is probably one of the harshest systems of capitalism in the world, because all capitalism doesn't look alike. And you can actually have capitalism like in the Western democracies in Europe that still takes care of its citizens but allows for some free markets. So to me, the fact that there is such fear that students will learn this history speaks to the power of knowledge. And that, you know, my personal hero, Ida B. Wells, said the people must know before they can act. And there is no educator like the press. And so I understand what it means to have your work suppressed in this way. And what it means is you can't suppress it. Like, Republicans have been selling lots of my books, let me be clear, right? Every time, you know, when I first pitched the project, I had what seemed like an incredibly audacious goal. I wanted Americans to know the date 1619. This date, you know, we got here before the Mayflower, on the ship called the White Lion. Every American child learns about the Mayflower in 1620. But that ship that carried our ancestors, which I would argue, of course, is more important than the Mayflower for the history of the country, has been completely erased. People know that date. Even Trump supporters, you know, people who love your governor, they know 1619. They imbue that date with power when they try to suppress it. Understanding our history is powerful. They don't want us. You know, when I took that one semester class, I became an incorrigible student. Right, because you start to challenge then. When you realize, when you start to see the mythology of your nation exposed, and you start to question, well, what else have I been lied about? And you don't become so gullible. You don't just accept these lies. And then you begin to challenge, because we kind of believe the society we have is the society that we have to have. Let me be clear. The critique of the project from the left is that it was too patriotic. And never in my life have I ever been accused of that. But what I realized is black patriotism is the true patriotism in this country, right? Because it's not performative. It's not about wearing a flag pin. It's about saying we have failed to live up to our highest ideals. And we are not going to abandon our country. We're not going to abandon those ideas. We are going to fight against our own country, generation after generation after generation, to force it to live up to its highest calling, not just for us, but for every marginalized people which we have fought for. And you have to ask, why is that dangerous? Why is that dangerous? You know, I'm the face of the 1619 Project, but the book is written by some of the greatest historians in our country. Right? Harvard historians, not that we put in the Ivy that was also funded with slave money on a pedestal, but I'm just saying, very credentialed historians. And who would not not want your children to read texts written by some of the greatest historians in our country. It is the fear of being supplanted as the only heroes in the story, of having to acknowledge. There's a great deal of psychology. I mean, Tulsa is about psychology, right? Because it is not a good thing to destroy a prosperous neighborhood in your city. That's illogical, unless you're racist. And racism is not logical, right? So when we understand the type of psychology that has to go into a country founded on ideals of liberty, of God-given rights, we hold these truths to be self-evident, all men are created equal, endowed by the Creator with inalienable rights, while you are enslaving one-fifth of your population, that takes a particular type of psychology to hold both of those opposing ideals in your head. And so the way that you hold them in your head is through denial. That's why you treat slavery as an asterisk. That's why we don't want to talk about the fact that the man who wrote the Declaration's occupation was to enslave people. The man who wrote the Constitution, enslaver. Bill of Rights, enslaver. Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death, enslaver. Right? You have to deny that because it's the only way you can deal with the hypocrisy of being a country founded on ideas of liberty while practicing slavery. And just to be clear, I'm not asking any white person to feel guilty for something you did not do. But we do have to acknowledge it. We have to atone for it. And we also, to me, we have to be truthful about our history. You don't have to have a personal shame for what happened a long time ago. You can have shame for what you do now, but you don't have to have shame for what happened a long time ago. But what's always interesting to me is folks want to claim the 4th of July, though you didn't sign that document yourself, you didn't sign the Declaration, right? Your ancestors might not even have been here during the Declaration, but you claim that. You claim all that shit. You don't get to just claim the good part, right? So you may not have personally enslaved someone. Maybe your ancestors had nothing to do, you know, we're not slave owners, but you don't get to claim the Declaration, but not the fact that the man who wrote that Declaration enslaved his own children. You have to claim all of that, is all that I'm saying. So, Nicole,
some of y'all looking a little uncomfortable. It's okay. I feel like some of y'all have never heard me talk before. It's okay. Is my security back there? Just playing.
So speaking about public schools in 1775, you've been very outspoken about your decision to send your daughter to a neighborhood public school in a low-income area.
Yes.
Tell us more about that, and have you changed your position on public schools now that all of these bills are being passed across the country?
So I'm the least optimistic person you will ever meet, and yet I have a profound hope in the power of public schools. I really do. I really do. You know, there's almost no place in American life now that the public, across class, across race, across religion, can intersect. 9 of 10 American children attend a public school, right? And it is, I believe strongly in a common good. I believe in public schools at their best in shaping citizens and giving access and giving the ability to transcend your circumstance. Now, of course, before I did 1619, most of my career was spent showing all the ways we fail to do that, right? But I believe in the power of public schools. So when I started my career covering school segregation, school inequality, the unfulfilled promise of Brown v. Board of Education for black children, and I remember, you know, I was a young reporter, and I would be interviewing people and activists and college professors who are all working in inequality, And then, and all working on behalf, they said, of black children, but then you would ask them, well, where do you send your children to school? Yes. And none of them ever sent their kids to school with the kids they said they were fighting for. Like, and I just remember thinking, like, man, that's so hypocritical. Like, how can you fight for kids that you're afraid to put your own children around? So, but I'll also say it's easy to have values when you don't have to live them. Which, you know, I didn't have any kids then. So I remember being like, well, when I have kids, I'm not going to do that. And then I had a child. And I had a child in New York City, which is one of the most segregated big city school districts in the country. New York is top three most segregated cities in the country. And I would live in a poor black neighborhood. And I had to decide, was I going to live my values? And for me, it was very easy. Of course I was. Because these are my neighbors. We lived in a community. I'm not afraid of our children. Now, my husband, you know, if you read the article, we had some arguments about it. We had to do some convincing because he grew up in the military. He never had the segregated school experience that's so common for black children because when you go to a base school, the school is integrated because the military doesn't allow that type of segregation on base when you can control where people go to school and where they live. And he was like, we fought hard to give our child every academic advantage that we didn't necessarily have, and now you want to give that up. And I was like, yes, yes, I do, because I felt it was important to live our values. I think the black folks in this room will know, when you come from a low-income black community and you show some potential, right, the first thing black folks tell you is, oh, you got to get out of here. Get your education and get out of here. And so we're told as a people that success means leaving our folks behind. Success means going to white institutions, going into white neighborhoods, and abandoning our community. And it was very important for me that I don't think that's how you define success. And I actually think I would never, of course, want to go back to the period of racial apartheid. But one thing that forced segregation did was black people crossed economic classes, lived in the same area, right? So we had that type of stability that came when all your professional folks were in the same community as the maids and the janitors, right? But now those of us who get that degree and get some success, we leave our communities. And then we wonder why they suffer. So to me, we know the help's not coming from outside. We had to save our own community. And that's why I enrolled my daughter in a segregated school. And we live in a segregated neighborhood. And I wish more of us. It's so funny because I began my journey as a school integration advocate. I still do believe that integration is the only way black children will ever get equal resources. But I also think we have to give up a lot for that sometimes. And I wasn't willing to give that up. I realized that we weren't going to integrate the New York City public schools, and so it was my job to use whatever power I could get for the benefit of our kids. And when it comes to CRT, the thing about these folks is they're really not that sophisticated, right? So, I mean, I say this is true. They tell you what they're doing. So Chris Rufo, the architect of the critical race theory propaganda campaign, said, the overall intent is to destroy public education. So you make all these parents have no trust in public schools. You make them think their children are being indoctrinated. You make up things like, you know, the teaching force is 80% white women, and yet we're somehow to believe that all these white women were telling white children they were evil and racist. Like, that doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense. But by sowing all these seeds of doubt and creating this frenzy, then you get people to distrust the public schools, and then you say, well, everyone should be able to just take their money and go to whatever school they want. So let's have vouchers, and let's be able to, you know, go to private school. So it all goes hand in hand. So we have to, if we want to save public schools, and I heard y'all are on the verge of maybe going charter, is that right? Okay, I'm not going to bring that up. I'm not going to bring it up. All I'm saying is, well, everybody knows I'm opposed to charter schools because I don't believe in publicly funded private schools. So They're also anti-democratic, right? They don't have to comply with public records. They don't have to have elected school boards. They're not democratic. And you never see charter schools in rich white communities. Show me one, just one. And I've covered education for 20 years. They don't go into those communities. They go into communities like this. Okay? So, anyway, I could give a whole lecture on public schools. My point is, if you believe in strong public schools, you have to oppose anti-CRT, right? You have to oppose all privatization measures, and you also have to oppose all of this inequality that we have allowed to fester. Because the reason black parents go to these schools is because they want to have some say over the education their kids have in schools that are not, that they don't feel are educating their kids. And oftentimes the charters aren't better, but those parents feel at least they have a choice. At least they have a say. So you can't maintain inequality and then say I'm against charters. Because parents won't go to charters if they believe that they can get a quality education in their traditional public school.
That's right, that's right. So real quick, shout out to all of our public school educators. If you're an educator, stand up, stand up. Thank you all so much. Thank you all so much. And we are running out of time, and so I have one final question, and I'm going to turn it over to Anika to allow you all to get your questions answered. So this is for the black women in the room. As black women, we so often become targets of vitriol attacks. And on the same level, I feel like every black woman in the room can relate to the very public attacks you and your work endure every single day, Nicole. How do you hold all of that and keep pushing forward? And what advice do you have for a black woman like myself and for like black women in this room who are attacked every day for standing up for what's just and for what's righteous?
Thank you so much for that question. One, let me just say, I hope you know how much respect I have for you. You are such an example of what we should not have to do, but too many of us end up having to do. You shouldn't be in the position that you're in because of what this country does to black families and black people. So I can't really give advice because I feel every black woman in here knows we do what we do because we don't have a choice. And there's never a day, I mean, I'm a human being. Sometimes it's hard when you get threats, when people, you know, someone threatened to burn my mother's house down, when you're on Fox News and you get the most ugly things written to you. I have a 12-year-old who Googles me now, and she can see the things that people are saying. Yes, that's hard, but it's expected. And the beauty of studying history is understanding that you don't do this work because you think you're going to get accolades. You do this work because it's the work that you're called to do. I talk a lot about my grandmother, Arlena Tillman. You shared your Mississippi background. My grandmother was born on a cotton plantation in Greenwood, Mississippi, as was my father. And they were born into a family of sharecroppers. My grandmother had a fourth grade education. And when my father was 2 years old, she decided her children were not going to pick cotton like she had, like her parents had, like her grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents had. And she got on a train to Illinois Central with a box of cold fried chicken that her mother had fried for her and her two young children. And the train was going to Chicago, but I always say we were so country, we got off the train too early and ended up in Waterloo, Iowa somehow. But this black woman with a fourth grade education was determined to change the trajectory of her family's life. And she never got to see what I became. She never got to see what her resolve not to raise her children in the feudal South would do. But every day I work in service of the debt that I can't repay to her. And so I don't ever struggle
I never lack for motivation because I know to whom I belong, my personal ancestors, my collective ancestors, and these folks have no idea what motivates someone like us. So they don't know how to destroy us because they don't know why we do what we do.
Thank you. That's a word. That's a whole word. So many of you had the opportunity when you came in to write questions on these cards. I'm a first grade teacher. I was able to read all of them. And we don't have a lot of time, so I think we may have time for two. So I'm going to go ahead and jump in with two. The first question is, as young professionals who are recent graduates or starting their careers, for the young folks who are about to venture out into the world, how would you encourage them to approach these discussions and this work? As we follow your work in scholarship?
That's a great question. Who asked that? What's your profession? Okay, so first of all, can we give a round of applause? Proud of you. Proud of you. So, you know, it's hard for me to give advice that will be specific enough to be helpful. What I'll say is you can't teach what you don't know. So the biggest part to me is spending as much time trying to soak in and learn as much as you can. And it's not your job necessarily to educate everyone else, right, unless you choose to. I feel like we often get put in positions where we have to be the spokesperson or, you know, we get added on to DEI work even though that's not actually our job and we're not getting compensated for it. So I feel like, you know, when you feel like educating, you do, and when you don't, you don't. But the advice that I give to young folks, and this is as someone who's clearly no longer young, is that you can only control that which is in your sphere of control, which is yourself. You can't control how people are going to perceive you. You can't control how people are going to treat you. If anything could be gleaned from what happened with my tenure debacle at the University of North Carolina last year, is you can do everything these folks tell you to do, get every credential, get every honor, and they'll just change the rules at the end, right? We know that. So you can't be worried about that. One thing that I knew, though, they couldn't deny me for anything that I didn't do or did do, right? But I could control my own excellence, and that's all that I could control. So as you go out and start your career, trust me, it doesn't matter what field you're in, we all face the same struggle. It's going to be a struggle. But control what you can control. It doesn't mean you'll make it where you're trying to make it necessarily. See, I don't give an uplifting talk. I try to be real. There's a lot of folks that were as smart or smarter than me, as ambitious as me or more, who didn't make it where I am. But at least if you don't, you know it's not because of anything that you could control that you didn't do. And you can't worry about folks outside of yourself.
All right, we have our final question of the evening. And before I ask this question, I want to acknowledge that at the beginning we took a moment of silence. And a lot of folks are saying, yes, let's continue to take these moments of silence, but also ensure that you are taking a moment of action.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would encourage everyone that's here tonight, when you leave, before you leave, before you go to bed, early in the morning, whenever it is, that you decide to take a moment of action, whether it's donating to organizations that are doing the work, like the Terrence Crutcher Family Foundation, whether it is educating yourself and reading literature like the 1619 Project, whether it's following folks on social media like Nate Morris, who will be sure to give you an action item and tell you who to call, make sure you are taking a moment of action. I also realize that as much as people believe that we enjoy talking about race and disparity and inequity, and as much as people like to say that we enjoy being divisive, that this is also heavy. And so the question is about hope, right? In light of all this, what makes you hopeful?
Who asked that?
Mike Sherman.
Okay. Thank you for asking. I was going to say that's a presumptuous question, but I won't say that. So, you know, I often get this question, and I know exactly where the question is coming from, so I'm going to respect where the question is coming from. Because I do realize that while I personally am not a hopeful person, I don't find hope useful. I'm more of a rage-motivated person. But I do understand that if people don't feel hope, then people don't feel motivated or the necessity to act, right? You have to believe, even though I don't believe we're ever going to be right in this country, you have to believe that we can dismantle these systems, or why are we here, right? What are we working for? And so I really go back and forth between feeling completely hopeless, that nothing will ever change, and then realizing there were folks like, you know, in 1855, Frederick Douglass could not have imagined that the institution of slavery could come to an end in a decade, right? That would have been ludicrous to think you could topple the slave state. But it did, right? And then you think about someone like Fannie Lou Hamer or Rosa Parks or Diane Nash, who couldn't have believed, it would have been nonsensical to believe you could end racial apartheid by law in this country. 100 years of that. And yet they had to believe they could do it, or what were they fighting for? So I go back and forth between not having personal hope, but realizing you can't give talks and ask people to go out and do some shit and then tell them that it's hopeless, probably not effective. So this is what I'll say. I think that hope has to be an action. And hope without action to me is useless. So when I think about all those people I just named, they didn't just sit and hope that society was going to change. They got out and made it change, right? Often at great personal risk to themselves. So we absolutely, the beauty of reading the 1619 Project or any of the hundreds of underlying texts is you realize that everything we see has been created. It was all intentionally architected. None of it's natural. None of it's inevitable. So if you understand that, then you know we can deconstruct everything in our society that we don't like. But that's going to be some hard work. And that's going to mean actually putting some skin in the game and not just coming to my talk and self-flagellating because I'm being mean, but like actually doing something. So nothing gives me hope except my child. But I do believe that we have to believe that the impossible can be made possible, because it has been made possible, but it's going to mean a bunch of very good people, very nice people who are presently doing nothing, have to turn that nothing and that hope into an action. Thank you for your question.
Where's Shada Brown? You got your action question answered. Last question, inquiring minds want to know, because this event was hosted by two amazing bookstores, Magic City Books and Fulton Street Books and Coffee, what are you reading outside of history, and what do you like to do for fun? Last question.
Thank you for that, because actually, yeah, all I really do read is history almost. My mom, 2 years ago, I asked for the four-part LBJ biography set, and my mom was like, you need to lighten the hell up. Like, nobody asked for that. Nobody asked for that for Christmas. And so she got me Number One Lady Detective Agency instead, which is actually quite great. So what I've started doing, because I really do love fiction, but I always feel like I don't have time to spend on fiction, because I always feel like if I'm reading, I need to be learning some more facts to wield against the country. But I just finished, so I started listening to books on audio while I'm out walking and things like that, because then I feel like I can't be reading history, because I need to outline the books. So I just finished, it's one of the best books I've read, but it's like two Bibles thick, The Love Song of W.E.B. Du Bois. Have any of y'all read that? I'm telling you, it was 26 hours on Audible, okay? It was very long, but it's so good. And then I just started Mothers on Audible, so I highly recommend it. And then what do I do for fun? I'm a very fun-loving person, in case y'all didn't know. So I like to drink too much bourbon. About to drink some when I leave here tonight. And I love to throw parties. And, one thing that is always good to remember, the 1619 Project, most of it is very heavy, very hard, very depressing. But also, through all of this, through the worst of circumstances, we've found joy, love, happiness. We created, right, like the backbone of American culture is all Black. First American literature was the slave narrative. Only original American music, right, is gospel, jazz, hip-hop, and blues. We created culture. And so it's always good to remind ourselves that we have to nourish our souls, nourish our humanity so that we can go out and keep fighting. And I think that's very important. It is those moments of joy that we all find, even in the most horrific of circumstances, that sustain us to go out and fight for the liberation of our people and all people.
It's never enough time, but give it up, everybody. Nicole, Hannah Jones, Onika, Asamoah Caesar. Thank you all so much.
Because I could paint on my face and my image, forego children to keep my body youthful, and restrict my breathing with corsets because I know this is how you like me. But what happens when you decide I'm no longer worth fucking? Oh, come on. I'll always take care. Not when you're dead and gone. There's an age difference between you and I, if you hadn't noticed. I am not family. I know what I am, I'm just vulnerable.
Oh, stop it.
I don't act like you don't know how this works. You've arranged it this way.
I've had enough of this. You come here of your own free will.
Free will? You have the free will around you that maybe me.
What's gotten into you?
Nothing.
And work with all of the audacity, some of which may be in her physical presentation she has lost today, but never in spirit, and Queen Mother Moore going across the South, saving lives of young Black men, and demanding reparations, forming the Ethiopian women, and somewhere in the back of her mind, with a concept of the legal idea of laches, meaning that if you have a right and you don't do anything about this right, then you can't claim it later. And Queen Mother and Dara Abubakar and Virginia Collins and others out of New Orleans and in the South formed the Ethiopian Women's Association. They went to New York. And indeed, Queen Mother would get her name from Baba Adefumi in New York. And they sent a missive to the United Nations in 1963 because they had an idea that unless within 100 years of the Emancipation Proclamation we made a formal demand to international sources, we might as well forget reparations, since they did it, to try to preserve for us the idea and the right to avoid this legal concept of laches. Queen Mother, Virginia Collins, women in the struggle, preserving for us this right. And all of you here, most of you here, except the very young, know the modern story. Republic of New Africa in 1968 formed because in large part of the work of Queen Mother, but these were the Malcolmites. The members of the Malcolm X Society formed after his assassination, who then called the Black Government Conference. And when we finished that block, and Betty Shabazz was there and leaned over and said to me, when they nominate, I would be willing to serve as second vice president. And she was named second vice president of the provisional government. And here, where a declaration of independence was concluded, part of it says, we claim no rights from America except those rights that belong to people all over the world. And these include the right to reparations for the grievous harm inflicted upon us, our people, by the United States. The Republic of New Africa people went into the streets. Some of you in Chicago may have first encountered provisional government people asking you to sign a petition. And incidentally, we have petitions out there now to support this bill of John Carney's, and I hope you'll take the opportunity to sign. And if you would like to be part of the National Reparations Coalition, just put an asterisk by your name, because there will be formal meetings here in Chicago. But then there's the African People's Socialist Party that began a series of tribunals calling people in to testify, to make a record as to reparations, as to the harm. And you lawyers who are in the audience know that one of the things that you do all the time is to value life. I mean, obviously you can't put dollar signs on somebody's life, but you have the task as lawyers to go into the courtroom, somebody's been hit by a public bus, and you evaluate the age of the person and how many years they would have lived if they had not been hit, and what they would have been if they had been able to get a little more education, and you value life. Obviously, no dollar signs can take the place of someone who has been killed or even injured. I mean, you don't want $2 million even for your leg. Really. Lawyers value life. And so the African People's Socialist Party undertook to make a record so that we can begin to say, what is it that they owe us? What is the minimum that they owe? And as you can plan in your mind, when you take into consideration the Middle Passage, when you take into consideration just the war waged against us in North America under the United States Constitution's provision of what we call the fugitive slave provision, which said that you could not even leave just peacefully and quietly and go away, because the whole force of the United States government, Army, Navy, Marines, stood against you, their court system stood against you, never mind that, as the sister said, they will cut off Gabriel's head and hang it on the post. Gabriel understood that if he lost the revolution, that they were going to do that to him. He knew what kind of people they were dealing with, so they stuck his head and those of his companions on the post, and arrayed the walks into the town of Richmond with these heads, so that everybody, and particularly the black people, would understand that you don't raise your hand against white people. So we understood. The revolutionaries understood that if they lost, that would be their suit. But what about the little old lady reading her Bible and decides, unlike the Hebrew, she won't take any gold and silver, won't say to the people who have been harming her, let me just borrow this so I can go out into the desert and pray. The little old lady who just leaves quietly at night, watching the North Star, barefoot. The full force of the United States government was against her, not just Gabriel or Nat Turner. And so the African People's Socialist Party began to make the record. Come in and testify. What can we say? And you know, what can they give us here? It was obvious before the calculations were even made that they owed us the whole thing. And so the African People's Socialist Party worked in the streets and in Baltimore and in Tallahassee and certain other places across the United States, trying to raise this consciousness. And in 1987, the provisional government's legislature. This is the national body. Hope some of you who really believe in land, who really believe that we should have independence, I hope some of you will run for this national Congress. It doesn't have any power yet because we're not free, but we need the Congress before we are free. I hope in the RNA elections this year, those of you who are really serious and will bring your talent and your money will run and be elected out of Chicago or wherever you may happen to live to this national body. They decided that we would try to call together black people from across this country to see if we could form a coalition that was not just land-based nationalists like myself, but that spread out to the sororities and the fraternities, the churches, that spread out to all groups. And we said we wanted to, at that time, work, make a more positive new African contribution to the freedom of our people in Southern Africa. And mind you, that's another story, but Africans have done much here. Now, we obviously can criticize ourselves and say we should do more, but we've done much here, and we wanted to do more. And we said the other thing, we'd use these twin things of reparations and South Africa. And we had long debates, and finally people said, let us just concentrate on reparations. And Nana Shisebe, who is the representative for the Pan-Africanist Congress of Azania, said, yes, do that. That will help us in South Africa. And so the National Conference of Black Lawyers came together with the provisional government and formed this National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America and COBRA. And as I said, the petitions are outside for you to sign, and if you want to work with this, please just put an asterisk beside your name. And in COBRA, maybe it was just the time. Came along at a time when a stalwart brother in Detroit who had worked with the movement and worked specifically with the Republic of New Africa, named Raymond Jenkins, a real estate broker who always put his money where his mouth was and his energy in his body, began another movement for reparations, and he went to a friend of his named Bill Owens, who's a senator in the Massachusetts legislature, and they talked. And Bill Owens said, look, I promised my father that if I ever got into a position to put in a reparations bill, I will do so. He did so. And so in Massachusetts, a bill has been put into the legislature saying that Massachusetts owes black people and should pay. Now, obviously, Massachusetts is not rushing to pass that resolution. And the way the brothers and sisters there are handling it, we will have opportunities to go and debate. And I want to come back to that, because this is a serious fight, and we need all of you. I mean, we've got some serious oppositions out there, and I'll come back to that. And then Ray Jenkins went back to Detroit, and he talked to some people on the Detroit City Council, and he talked to the county governing body, and both of those bodies passed a resolution saying that the United States ought to pay the reparations. I mean, that's kind of interesting. Detroit and Michigan owe also for what they did to us after slavery. But anyhow, they at least passed a reparations resolution demanding that Detroit act. And incidentally, Miss Janita Tolson of Baton Rouge was kind enough to come here with me. We're both members of the Baton Rouge and COBRA group, and of course I helped to form it, but they sort of run this thing by themselves and tell me that they do. But in Baton Rouge, Peggy Buchter and Herbert Buchter, who are our leaders there, have been able to get the Louisiana State House, one of the brothers in the Louisiana State House to put in the reparations motion demanding that Louisiana support the Conyers bill. And now they have a second reparations amendment which demands that Louisiana pay itself. So, and that hasn't been put in yet, but we expect that it will in the next few weeks. So the history of reparations is continuous. And Queen Mother Moore's concern about laches does not have to really concern us. But then we recall that the United States has never really given us any kind of justice except when they were forced to. For those of us who were in the RNA 11 and went to jail in Mississippi after they tried to shoot us up and they died, it is always a bit of ironic humor to hear people talk about the system works. They're talking about Huey Newton got out of jail, but you know, as I know, that you got him out. The American system did not gratuitously turn Huey Newton out of jail. They look at Angela Davis. System works. The United States system did not gratuitously turn Angela Davis out. The system doesn't work. And we have to force the system to do things. So whether or not there's a doctrine of laches that could possibly have stood in our way, it really couldn't, because we have never forgotten reparations. It really doesn't matter to our enemies, and the United States is our enemy until they are willing to sign a peace treaty. As you know, they never signed it with Elijah Muhammad, not to mention Denmark Vesey, Gabriel. They haven't signed it with the Republic of New Africa, never apologized to you. Even the bill in Congress that I mentioned that was going to make it possible for you to buy 40 acres, never apologized to you. The United States is our enemy until they cease this war against us. Now, the enemy has to be forced. If they don't have laches, they're going to think of something else. And this is what I meant when I said we have a serious problem. Let me move on to John Conyers' bill. John Conyers' bill asks for a commission to study the harm that was done to black people during slavery and afterwards by discrimination. And I know what you say, another commission? Andy Thompson and all these political scientists know that when you set up a commission, that's a way to get rid of the problem. What you do is you create a commission to say, we're doing something, folks. And then when the commission report comes out, you say, thank you, and you put it on your desk, and that's the end of it. But Kanye's plan is, in a way, an opportunity for us to bring testimony to Congress and shape a bill. That's what it comes down to. Now, that's easy, isn't it? Everybody knows that they killed somewhere close to 80% of the people that they put on those slave ships, right? And we all know that they took our names and our common sense. I mean, you're too familiar with that. I won't even go into that. Assaulted our personality and only your vigor. I just sit back and, I mean, I'm so happy to be a new African, a black person. I sit back and marvel at you all. You just never stay still and never accept what people attempt to put on you. Now, we can criticize each other about what we do and that this is dumb or that's dumb. That's fine. We're entitled to criticize each other, and we're entitled to perfect a proper approach to our liberation. But you are so busy organizing everywhere, achieving in educational fields and just doing everything that they told you you couldn't do, flying space shuttles, commanding, becoming mayors, even though you sometimes forget who you are, and just doing every kind of thing. I remember when I worked for the Army Tank Automotive Command, and I would go to different cities, and sure enough, because I was a writer for technical manuals, and we'd go there to supervise this writing of manuals, and I'd look around, and there, in many cases, there was some black engineer, even in those days, sitting in the back doing a whole lot. So such a dynamic people, who never simply sat by and said, boss, don't hit me, and I'll just be happy to be here. Such a dynamic fighting people. But we got problems. Because you have heard that revisionist economists tell us that it wasn't too bad in slavery economically. That the poor white workers in the North had more of their surplus value taken from them than we did, right? So don't think that you can walk up to Congress backwards and blindfolded and throw the ball through the hoop. There's going to be some folks up there that are going to tell you, y'all didn't have it bad, and while we're thinking about it, we ought to help the white folks. So the economists have to come in with their serious work done. We look at Hofstadter, he said, well, you know, Professor Hofstadter, great guy, said that something like 12,000 black people, this is not exact figures, were all those that went into North America. Now here at the end of the Civil War, we're 4 million people held in slavery, and remember, part of that re-education, never allow the students to say slaves. It's people held in slavery. But you never forget the repression and the resistance. No slaves, people held in slavery. Now, we say, well, certainly we lost all these people in the Middle Passage. And they say, did you? I say, like, remember that some of our figures, we run 100 million. They say, we think that they pulled 100 million people out of Africa, or at least between those killed in Africa and those who died on the way, 100 million people. And these white folks say, no, that didn't happen. There weren't even 100 million people living in Africa there. You see? You got serious problems as we begin to, as the lawyers do, value life. And so our historians have to be prepared. Don't get mad at John Conyers because he put in a bill asking for a commission. Just get yourself together to come down there with your facts right when the hearings open. It may not be this year. It may be later. And what else? Now, I think Brother Hannibal told me I'm going to have a chance tomorrow to talk something about the Republic of New Africa, but I just want to mention this to you. We in the provisional government take the position that black people should not say we're American citizens. I mean, this relates to also this question of our using the term African American. And I asked one of my colleagues, I said, Ron Walters, who was one of those who pushed, I said, look, Ron, you know, why use this term African-Americans? Because, you know, we're not Americans. And he said, yeah, but just to get us to say African now is such an improvement that maybe we ought to take this step. But what concerns us is maybe let's just say African. We're just Africans. I mean, like, we don't say we're Africans in the New World, so we're new Africans, or Africans because in the 200 years between 1660 and 1860, we have, what, 10, 7 generations? And in that time, who were these Africans? They didn't come from one country, one state, one nation in Africa. They came from several. I mean, even though they say, well, we came basically from the West Coast, but you remember, it was the Portuguese who attacked into the Angola region, and who also went around and attacked themselves into Mozambique. And so we came from all over the continent. And here we had many people from many different nations who could not stay together. In Africa, you knew who you could marry. Once you get here, you've got to marry the fellow or the woman who was next to you. And so we have in America across 7 to 10 generations a fusing of people from many different African nations and states. And then you've got the Indian genes and you've got the European genes in our gene pool. And so here then you have a common history that solidifies the people. We know, we say we know who's black. And how do we know that? Here I am walking around looking like I'm white, even got blue eyes. How do you know I'm black? You know it because, not only because the gene pool, because you know my brother and sister who may not have blue eyes and fair skin, not only because of gene pool, but you know it also because of the common perspective. and the common history. So when we look, for instance, at people on the same territory in the same space, maybe it's easier if we look, say, at the Mohawk or the Passamaquoddy or some of those in New York or New England. Here, when the whites come, the Europeans come to Massachusetts, they are on the same land with the Passamaquoddy. They are in the same time frame. They are experiencing the same event, which will be war, because we read the end of the book, so we know it turns into war. So here they are, same time, same place, same time frame, two different perspectives. The whites are saying, oh God, thank you for giving us this wonderful land. And the Indians are saying, much like we do, God, what did we do to lose this land? Or as we would say, God, what did we do wrong, Brother Shanga, to get us in this mess? What can we do to get out of it? See, same time, same place, same event, two different perspectives. And those two different perspectives...
My name is Earl Pinto, and I am the guest host of the Flo Kennedy Show. We are greatly honored to have as our guest today a great woman, a freedom fighter for African people throughout the world. Her name is Queen Mother Moore. Welcome, Queen Mother.
Thank you.
How did you become known as Queen Mother Moore?
Well, that name was bestowed upon me by the African students, first of all, as a result of my years of activities in this country. They gave it to me. And when I went to Africa to Dr. Nkrumah's funeral, the chief heard about me, and he sent for me to come to him. And I went, and he said, I'm going to make you officially Queen Mother of the Ashanti. And he initiated me Queen Mother. But I was Queen Mother before I went to Africa.
Did you personally know the late Kwame Nkrumah?
Yes, I did. I knew him here.
Okay, you met him while he was visiting here?
Yes.
Okay, and that is in conjunction with your work.
Yes.
I understand that you sent a petition to the United Nations, I think 1957, for reparations for the black people in America. Explain something about that to us.
Yes, the petition called for us to go back to Africa, for those who wanted to go back. And for those who wanted to stay here, there had to be certain indemnity given for the people who wanted to stay, the people who wanted to go.
What kind of indemnity?
Well, I was asking for $200
billion. $200 billion?
Dollars.
To indemnify?
Yes, for the injury that we have received. The injury as a result of our enslavement.
Okay, that's for our 400 years of enslavement?
Yes.
As reparations, you requested $200 billion.
Yes.
Okay, when you sent this petition to the United Nations, what kind of response did you get?
I got a very good response. He told me that we needed a member nation to introduce the resolution, since we were not officially members of the UN.
Is this with your work with the Republic of New Africa?
No, that was not. I went as a member of the Ethiopian Women, the Universal Association of Ethiopian Women.
I understand that you founded that organization.
Yes.
And what was that organization about?
To save our men from execution. They were being executed at the rate of two a week almost. there was somebody being executed.
Then unjustly executed?
Yes, we felt they were unjustly executed. And we tried to save some of them. We did save some.
Mention a few.
From execution. Labatt and Porret. We saved those. We saved Jenkins. We saved another brother.
Well, there was a number of people that were saved from execution because they were unjustly charged with crimes.
Yes.
And where did this take place?
In New Orleans.
Okay, you're from New Orleans,
yes.
I understand. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also work with Marcus Garvey.
Yes.
Tell us first something about Marcus Garvey.
Well, I was first brought into the Marcus Garvey movement by the fact that I understood that he was to come and speak to us in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to the meeting, and lo and behold, he didn't come. And we heard that the mayor refused to allow him to come. So we were very incensed about it and got a delegation to go see why. And then it was guaranteed that Marcus Garvey would come the next night. And the hall was packed with people. And everybody went with ammunition.
They had guns?
They had guns. Everybody had guns. Blue Steel, Smith & Wesson's, German Lugers. They had plenty of German Lugers because, you know, the war had boys from the war and everything.
Okay.
And I had two guns with me, and they all had guns and ammunition, a bag of ammunition. Everybody had what you call a suitcase today. We used to call satchels.
What was all this?
Of ammunition.
Why were you so armed?
Because we were afraid the police would stop him from coming again.
Okay.
And we wanted to protect him. And so we went. 3,500 people was in that hall. And so when Garvey came, we applauded very much. And he said, "My friends, I want to apologize for not speaking to you last night. But the reason I didn't speak to you is because the mayor permitted himself to be used as a stooge by the police department to prevent me from speaking to you." And when he said that, the police jumped up and said, "I'll run you in." And when the police did that, everybody jumped up on the benches. We had benches then.
Uh-huh.
And took out their guns straight up. The guns were straight up in the air. "Speak, Garvey, speak." And Garvey said, and as I was saying, and he went and repeated himself. And the police filed out of there like little puppy dogs with their little tails between their legs. Every policeman filed out of the hall.
Okay, after which I understand you started a chapter of his organization?
No, I didn't start a chapter. Okay. We had a chapter going down there.
Okay. Uh-huh. And you purchased stock in
the Black Star Line, yes.
What was that? What was the Black Star Line?
Black Star Line was ships that Marcus Garvey was buying.
For what purpose?
To go to Africa. To go to Africa and to trade with Africa. He was going to trade with the West Indies and Africa.
And what was the result of the purchase of the ships? Did they ever get to Africa?
No, the people sabotaged the ships. There was great sabotage. You know, on Garvey's board, he had a lot of enemies of our people. You couldn't talk about Africa in those days without expecting the agents to be around you. You had the agents of Belgium, you had the agents of France, you had the agents of England, and all those agents were sitting on his board.
Oh, trying to sabotage his work.
And yes, in the form of black skins.
Okay.
You see? So they sabotaged the ships.
All right.
And then they charged Garvey with fraud because they were saying that he was selling unworthy ships, you know.
How did the work of Marcus Garvey influence your life?
Oh, very much so. Oh, yes, because he taught me about the glories of Africa. I never went to sleep anymore since then. Never. I did much study since then of my own.
On the mm-hmm. glories of Africa.
Yes.
You've made numerous trips to Africa.
Yes.
I understand that you recently attended the Women's Conference, the International
yes.
Women's Conference.
Yes, yes.
Tell us about that.
Yes, that was very great. It was very widely attended with 8,000 women.
Okay.
Yes.
During your travels, recent travels to Africa, you went to Ethiopia, I understand.
Yes, I went to Ethiopia.
Did you witness some of the famine?
No, they didn't let us go there. We didn't see anything of the famine. You wouldn't even know they had a famine.
I guess
they kept that from the people.
I guess that's sometimes like people visiting New York never get to see Harlem and Bedford Stuyvesant.
That's right. That's right. That's
okay,
right.
They just show you the...
That's right, the part they want you to see. That's right.
You have land in upstate, Parksville, I believe it is. Where
yes.
It's, you have the Mount Addis Ababa.
Mount Addis Ababa.
Okay. And you doing work on that mountain.
Well, we want to build there a college of African studies. We want to build a monument to the 100 million Africans who perished in the slave trade. And for those who died since, all the people who died in the struggle. 100 million. 100 million died in the slave trade, yes.
So that's our Holocaust.
Yes, that's our Holocaust.
Holocaust,
yes.
All right, this institution that you want to build, the purpose of it will be to educate black people?
Yes, to educate our people, to help our people to understand, to denegroize us. To denegroize us, change our minds from European minds. You know, we have no idea the condition that we're in, the psychoneurosis that we suffer. We suffer a terrible, terrible blight. We don't know who we are. We use European names, and we just are comfortable with our condition. We really don't know who we are. We have no idea. We're captive. And we're absolutely comfortable with this situation.
I know I feel personally very honored that you had given me an African name, Menelik.
And don't you feel better?
I feel a lot.
That's
a
right.
lot better. And most of my friends
yes.
call me by
yes.
Menelik.
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
what is the significance of that name?
That name is meant, it's great, it's an Ethiopian name.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You're working with Mount Addis Ababa, and you're going to erect a monument to commemorate the 100 million
yeah.
blacks that had died?
Africans.
Africans.
Yes, Africans, yes.
Okay, you have an organization that's working with this effort?
Yes, yes. They perished in the slave traffic.
Okay. What are some of the other works, things that you're personally involved in presently?
Well, that's mostly what I'm taking up with now, trying to build that monument and trying to build the institute.
The institute?
Yes.
Oh, that's the school?
Yes.
You once told me that you were fighting for the freedom of Lizzie Williams.
Oh, for Lizzie Williams, yes. Lizzie Williams, bless her heart. She's so dear. She just sent me a Christmas card with $5 in it. She's so wonderful.
She was sentenced?
She was sentenced to 218 years in prison. She's in her 70s.
Why was she sentenced?
For perjury in Alabama. For perjury. Her boyfriend stole two chickens, and she swore that he was with her. And they charged her for that. For lying, you know, that he was with her instead of stealing the chickens. And then charged her with accessory to the crime.
I understand that you was instrumental in breaking Jim Crow in the baseball league.
Yes. You know, at one time, there was Jim Crow in the league that blacks couldn't play. And the people, especially the Jewish people, was fighting Jim Crow in the big league. And they asked me to head the committee to fight Jim Crow in the big league. And of course, I was a Negro then. I used to be a Negro. And everything sounded good to me. The Negro fights Jim Crow and that kind of thing. And I fought Jim Crow. And I didn't realize what I was doing. If I hadn't been a Negro, I wouldn't have fought to get a Negro in the big league. I wouldn't have did that. I would have fought to get a team in the big league. One of our baseball team. We had great teams. I dismantled the teams. My work dismantled the teams. We had neighborhoods where our ball games would play and the children was happy and the old ladies was selling pies and things at the ball games and children was shining shoes and we had hotels and it was something when they had a ball game in town. But all of that's dismantled. All of that, there's no more hotels or anything. You see, Jim Crow has done away with all of that.
Excuse me. I would like to reintroduce our guest. Our guest today is Queen Mother Moore. This is the Flo Kennedy Show. Queen Mother, you said that you were a Negro at the time, and you wished to, and you wanted to, you wished that you had put teams instead of individuals into the league. Was you instrumental in getting Jackie Robinson into the league?
I was interested in breaking Jim Crow. And yes, Jackie came as a result of that. And Statue Page and all of those people, I didn't know them. But they all was employed as a result of breaking Jim Crow in the big league. That's right.
Uh-huh. Your work with the Universal Association of Ethiopian Women resulted, I understand, in putting welfare recipients back on the roll?
Oh, the welfare dismissed 23,000 families from the roll, put them off, white and black, mothers with illegitimate children, just threw them off. Sent the mother's letter saying, this is your last letter you're going to receive. The last welfare you got, the last one, is the last one you're going to get. Not the next one you're going to get, but the last one you receive. The one you've eaten up is the last one you're going to get.
That's
right. And told the Red Cross, don't help these people. They're illegitimate and they're not entitled to help. Told the Charity Hospital not to help them. Told the Salvation Army, don't give them a thing because they're not entitled. So the mothers had nowhere to go. We had to help the mothers to get food. We went around and begged the stores to give us food. The French market gave us food, baskets, cartons of food, and the bakeries gave us baskets of bread, all of their stale bread they gave us. And the pharmacists gave us medicine for the babies and all.
Were these 23,000 families eventually restored to the welfare rolls?
They were, yes. Louisiana was called to Washington for a hearing. Say, why have you cut these people off? And Long got up and said that two states had cut them off, and he didn't hear any ruckus about it. And why all this fuss about going on in Louisiana? I say, because you didn't have any Ethiopian women in those states. And they wrapped the gavel for me because that was a judicial hearing. It wasn't to be anyone to speak. But I spoke there. I said, because you didn't have any Ethiopian women.
I was told that the Ethiopian women had helped the Ethiopians after, I think, Mussolini attacked Ethiopia during the war.
Oh, yes. We played a great role in getting clothing and getting food, getting things, sheets. Went to the laundry and got sheets and got the nurses to sterilize the sheets and roll them up in bandages to send to Ethiopia. Oh, yes.
Did the supplies reach Ethiopia?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Did you ever meet the emperor at the time?
I've never met the emperor personally, but I've seen him a lot of times.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is your work now is with the monuments, you said, and you want to push forth the idea of building a monument on Mount Abu Sabaiba.
Yes, it's absolutely necessary, very necessary for our people to understand that we must build that monument to those millions, 100 million who perished during the traffic of slavery.
Is this monument going to be a physical building?
It's going to be a school, a college, a big everlasting monument. Yes. And we're going to have African students to come and attend this school, too.
I was in the library not long ago, and I saw your picture in the main library at 42nd Street in New York. What was that about?
Well, Schlesinger sent throughout the country, they gathered pictures of the outstanding women, the most militant women, the women who have made the greatest contribution, over 70 years old. They had to be over 70.
How old are you now?
Yes, I'm 87.
87?
Yes, I'm 87.
And these women were over 70 years
old?
Yes,
they had to be over 70 years old. And I was one of the 10 outstanding women that they had in the country. And they made my picture.
That was a great honor.
Yes, it was. Very great. And they put it in the library.
Okay. And also in the...
On 42nd Street and in the Schomburg Library.
And I think there was a meeting there at the Schomburg commemorating the women who were selected. Yes. We have... not much time left in this program. And would you be able to sum up what you think a message, let's say for black youth or Africans, that would help them in knowing themselves and being a contributor to their race?
Yes, well, I think the most important thing is to study and to find your name, who you are, to get a name for yourself. You have to get a name. Don't go through life with a European name. You've got to put down that name. Just take a name. Just take an African name and name yourself. And learn who you are. That's
How would you suggest that a young person go about that?
Well, you got to look yourself in the mirror. Who are you? Who are you? Most of our people don't know who they are. They don't know. They think in European. They don't have a mind of their own. They got to get their right mind back. They can't think. They can't think. I don't care if you have your PhD. Don't tell me you've gone to the best colleges. The best college didn't give you your identity, didn't give you a national identity at all. You've got to be able to comprehend what you think, and you've got to be able to understand and think for yourself and stop thinking in the pattern that the other people want you to think all the time.
You think this begins with taking upon yourself an African name?
Well, yes.
And that has great significance and, I guess, influence over the mind.
Yes.
I know it has for me.
Yes.
So you suggest that the young black people take upon themselves an African name to get to know who they are.
That's right. I didn't have to change my name because the Moors were a great nation of Africans, you see. I didn't have to do that.
So you were born with an African name.
I was born a Moor.
Very good. Mm-hmm. We have here Queen Mother Moor, and this is the Flo Kennedy Show. Thank you very much. See you next time.